Why Words Matter, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump calls some immigrants animals, and to many, it's more than just a crude remark.
We need to understand the danger of our president holding these views that some people are not human and enacting policies that operationalize that belief.
Also, Russian President Vladimir Putin used to be known for his folksy speaking style, but not anymore.
The sort of saltiness, the guy down the street, slightly crude language, we just don't hear that anymore at all.
Plus, a musician in Botswana who is really close to his instrument.
This is why I call her my girlfriend. We never part.
Those stories and Germany's unicorn craze, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is Thursday, and thanks for being here. Supporters of President Trump often say they like him because he says what he thinks. Critics would argue he says without thinking. What the president says on Twitter, on TV, it really does matter. And we're going to focus today on a couple of instances that deserve special scrutiny. Later in the show, we'll dig into what Trump has said about torture. But first, a comment he made at a roundtable discussion with California officials yesterday.
We have people coming into the country, or trying to come in. We're stopping a lot of them. But we're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before.
Trump's tried to clarify his comments. He says that he was referring to members of violent gangs. But calling some people animals has a real-world impact, according to Omar Jadwat. He directs the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project.
What it leads to is the idea that because people aren't people, you can ignore their basic humanity. And in fact, that's what we see this administration doing with respect to immigrants. Almost every day we open up the newspaper, you see them ripping children away from their parents as a way to deter people from fleeing persecution in their homelands. For example, one of our clients, a Congolese woman who escaped persecution in the Congo, made it all the way to the United States, came to our border, passed an interview where they determined that she had a credible fear of persecution. And then they took her 7-year-old daughter, who was traveling with her, away and took that daughter 2,000 miles away and held them separately for months and didn't allow them to come back together until we filed the lawsuit. The only way you can do that sort of thing to a family is if you don't recognize their humanity. And if you put into practice that rhetoric that says these people aren't people, they're animals.
What was the context in which Trump used this word to describe immigrants as animals? I mean, wasn't he referring to something a sheriff in the room had just said about MS-13?
The kind of statement that he had responded to from the sheriff was a complaint about California's law that tries to keep the state and its municipalities out of the business of immigration enforcement. The sheriff was complaining about that law, and in the context of complaining about that law, made a reference to MS-13. Nothing that the president said specifically referenced MS-13. But the deeper problem is that even if the president was only talking about people that he thinks are gang members, those people are people too. The idea that you would dehumanize any segment of the population, any segment of people who the government's interacting with, and try to put them on the other side of the line is problematic, especially when this government regularly accuses people of being gang members and treats them as gang members and tries to take away their liberty.
Yeah, wasn't there a case just this week that was thrown out by a judge where I think it was in the Northwest, a kid who had DACA status was picked up by ICE and they said he was a gang member with no proof?
Exactly. We represent, for example, a group of young people who have been ripped out of their schools and communities on the basis of these gang allegations and put in juvenile jails because of things like the fact that they are wearing sneakers that ICE thinks are associated with gang membership, or they've doodled a country code in their school notebook that they think is associated with a gang. And when, because of our lawsuit, the government has to come into court and actually make a case for why these kids are gang members, they can't do it.
It's easy to see what Trump said as hateful speech, but deporting, separating families, that began under Obama. He ramped up big time the alien transfer exit program that deported immigrant men away from their families by sending them to parts of Mexico way far away from their actual homes. Obama was also known as a deporter in chief. So when it comes to the deeds, what does the record show? That Trump is deporting more people than Obama?
We sued the Obama administration many times for many problems with the way that they enforced the immigration laws and the way they acted towards immigrants. But what we have seen with the Trump administration is taking those policies that were pioneered and making them much worse. And so instead of merely deporting people away from their family members who were living in the country to also, at the very moment that people reach the country when they're at their most vulnerable, to separate them at that point from their kids and keep the kids alone and away from their parents.
And then there is the case of the customer at a New York deli this week who was melting down after apparently overhearing employees speaking Spanish. He threatens to call immigration authorities in the video, which you may have seen. Is that being fed by the person in the White House using this kind of rhetoric?
I think there is a clear way in which the rhetoric that the president uses and the way he talks about people does influence the way that people interact with each other, you know, in everyday life. And where he's gone and where he's going is enacting a whole suite of policies that really does treat people as less than human. And that's something that we should not stand for in this country.
Omar Jadwat, who directs the Immigrants' Rights Project at the ACLU. What a president says and what a president doesn't say. Let's take a look at Russian President Vladimir Putin. Over the years, he's been known for his, let's say, colorfully mean-spirited answers to journalist questions. You're about to hear a couple of times when Putin crossed the line or came real close. You might not want the kids to listen. Michelle Birdie writes the Wordsworth column for the Moscow Times, so you've kind of seen how Putin's language has evolved over time. Take us back to the 2000s. Describe Putin's language then, and how did it influence how Russians thought of him?
When Putin became president, and at first when he was prime minister, on the one hand, he spoke very well. Russians are very fussy about language usage. So when he was giving a speech, his stress was in the right place. He conjugated all of his verbs properly. But occasionally he would go off script and he would say something that was either very bawdy, sort of verging on obscene, or he would say something that you would only hear in a village, and people would go running to their dictionaries to try to figure out what on earth he was talking about. Journalists would kind of rush to be the first one to report on whatever fascinating, interesting, bizarre thing he said this time.
Well, we've got two examples of Putin's language that have become pretty famous. Let's hear this in Russian. Mm-hmm. You can tell me what he's saying.
Мы будем преследовать террористов везде, в аэропорту, значит, вы же меня извините, в туалете поймаем. Мы...
This was 1999 when he was still prime minister, and there were a number of apartment house bombings, and it was a very, very tense situation. And what he was saying was, we're going to go after these terrorists everywhere. If they're in the airport, we're going to get them in the airport. And forgive me, but if we catch them in the toilet, we're going to waste them in the toilet, if that's what it takes. The reaction to it actually was very positive, I think, because it was a very frightening period for a lot of people. And here you had this young prime minister. He was very straightforward. He was slightly crude, but he was going to get these guys.
I noticed something I'm looking at my translation of that quote here, and it says, if we catch them in the toilet, we'll waste them in the outhouse. Which strikes me, that's kind of a rural thing. So is he like addressing both city people and country people?
Could be. The word he uses is a word that I couldn't translate given current laws on use of obscenities.
We'll use our imagination.
Salty expression. And again, it has that kind of folksy, down-to-earth kind of street slang, village talk aspect to it. And I think actually at the time that was very appealing to people.
All right, here's another example of Putin and his special language.
Если вы хотите совсем уж стать исламским радикалом, и готовы пойти на то, чтобы сделать себе обрезание, то я вас приглашаю в Москву.
This was 2002, and it was a press conference about Chechnya when there was a war going on.
Right.
And I believe it was a French journalist who asked him a question, and he got very testy about it. And what he replied was, if you want to become an Islamist radical and are ready to undergo circumcision, then come to Moscow. We've got specialists for this, and I'll recommend that they do it so that absolutely nothing can grow back for sure. This was very funny because the first translator froze, and there was this moment of silence. The Russian side of the audience is hooting with laughter. The foreign side is waiting to hear the punchline. And finally, you could hear the other translator saying something like, oh, please come to Moscow. We are a multinational country, and you will be very happy here, or something like that. But since the Russians were already laughing, the foreign journalist wanted to know what was so funny, and it eventually came out.
Do you have any other favorite moments where Putin kind of just let loose?
He would say things like, you've got to follow the law all the time, not just when they've got you by the short and curlies. Or we've got to stop chewing on our snot and playing at politics. We've got to do something. Chewing on your snot is kind of a Russian expression for what we would say picking your nose.
You've noticed a change, though, in Putin's rhetoric. I mean, his language these days in 2018, you write, is boring in comparison. What do you mean by that?
In the old days, I used to call his speeches Mr. Putin's language lessons, because there was always something that came up. There was some use of kind of villagey, folksy expressions that people really didn't understand, even Russians. And that has not happened since he came back to the presidency in 2012. He very rarely breaks away from the script.
And what's that changed about, do you think?
Well, of course, I don't know. He and I are not exactly close. But certainly it does reflect his presidential persona. You know, it's as if he started off as kind of a scrappy guy, maybe didn't entirely know how to handle himself. And now he feels that he is the president with a capital P.
You've said before that President Trump sounds different when his words are translated into Russian. Are Putin's words cleaned up when he's translated into English?
Whether it's intentional or almost subconscious, I think the translators do clean him up a little bit. And they have certainly over the years cleaned up Trump. Trump sounds a lot better in Russian than he sounds in English.
So we need to point the fingers at the translators to understand Trump and Putin's reputations around the world.
Yeah, the first couple of times Putin kind of went off script, I was very curious about the standard, say, at the United Nations. If a leader of state is speaking and he says something obscene or inappropriate, do they translate it? What I was told by all of the interpreters I spoke to was the rule is yes. But then they all said, but there was this one time and I just couldn't do it. You know, when you open your mouth, even though you're interpreting and those aren't your words, it feels as if it's coming from you. It's psychologically a little bit more difficult than you might imagine.
Michelle Burdy writes the Wordsworth column for the Moscow Times. Good to speak with you today, Michelle.
Thank you. Take care.
A quick word now before the break, and the word is unicorns. They're back in a big way, at least in Germany, where folks are taking their unicorn obsession to a whole another level. It started with chocolates, but quickly expanded to unicorn cookies, unicorn yogurt, unicorn smoothies, and unicorn gel, whatever that is. Madeline Schwartz wrote about this unicorn business for The Atlantic. She's a reporter and fellow at the Robert Bosch Foundation in Berlin. And it seemed to her that unicorns are just about everywhere you look in Germany. But,
you know, one funny thing I had when reporting this story is that I felt that I saw unicorns everywhere. And every German person who I asked said, unicorns? Really?
They didn't see them?
They didn't see them.
But now it sounds like they're seeing them now.
Well, definitely it's a trend that's been reported on in the press here. At the most recent carnival, unicorns were a very popular costume on the subways here in Berlin. One subway that I rode, someone took the dogs allowed sign and sort of drew a little unicorn horn on it. So I think they're pretty inescapable.
Where is the weirdest place you've seen a unicorn?
I think it was, I went to visit the German Stock Exchange with the fellowship that I'm on, and we had a coffee across the street at a very, very stately restaurant, and it had already become a sort of a topic of discussion among Americans in Germany, how many unicorns there were. And as we looked up, we saw a very, very stately imperial-looking unicorn staring down on a very formal restaurant full of German bankers.
Well, I asked for weird and I got it. That was Madeline Schwartz in Berlin, filling us in on the unicorn craze in Germany. Later in the show, real handshakes across a fake border in South Korea. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Donald Trump's made it pretty clear where he stands on torture. Here he is in 2016 on the campaign trail.
They asked me, what do you think about waterboarding, Mr. Trump? I said, I love it. I love it. I think it's great. And I said, the only thing is we should make it much tougher than waterboarding. And if you don't think it works, folks, you're wrong.
Trump still believes it works, but he and his team are now facing more questions about torture. Gina Haspel, the president's pick to be the new director of Central Intelligence, oversaw some of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques used by the CIA after 9/11, a fact that California Senator Kamala Harris brought up at Haspel's confirmation hearings last week.
Do you believe that the previous interrogation techniques were immoral?
Senator, I believe that CIA officers to whom you referred...
It's a yes or no answer. Do you believe the previous interrogation techniques were immoral? I'm not asking, do you believe they were legal? I'm asking, do you believe they were immoral?
Senator, I believe that CIA did extraordinary work to prevent another attack on this country, given the legal tools that we were authorized to use.
Please answer yes or no. Do you believe in hindsight that those techniques were immoral?
Senator, what I believe sitting here today is that I support the higher moral standard we have decided to hold ourselves to.
Can you please answer the question?
Senator, I think I've answered the question.
No, you've not. Do you believe the previous techniques, now armed with hindsight, do you believe they were immoral? Yes or no?
Senator, I believe that we should hold ourselves to the moral standard outlined in the Army Field Manual.
You've not answered the question, but I'm going to move on.
But a few days later, Haspel wrote a letter to the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. She stated that the CIA should never have detained terrorist suspects and employed brutal interrogation techniques. The Senate panel endorsed Haspel, and today she was confirmed as the new director of Central Intelligence. For writer and journalist Theo Padnos, torture is not just something that's discussed in committee chambers on Capitol Hill. He was captured, held, and tortured by al-Qaeda in Syria for nearly 2 years. Padnos has written an open letter to Gina Haspel in Rolling Stone magazine.
Basically, those al-Qaeda people, they treated me to the same tortures that the U.S. interrogators have subjected their al-Qaeda suspects to. They were kind of revenging against the CIA on me.
And how do you know the methods were the same?
I don't know for sure, because we don't know exactly what they're doing to people in Guantanamo, but let's just say that they improvised their own little water torture device for me. And they did the stress positions. They did, you know, all the humiliations. And there were times when I was in a room with other Syrians, and the Syrians got the Syrian torture, and I got the American torture.
What was the difference?
I mean, they don't waterboard their Syrian prisoners. They did to me.
As you write in Rolling Stone, as you awaited that first torture session, you wondered whether it would be one interrogation, more than one, but it went on for 20 months. You were tortured, beaten in near solitary confinement for over 200 days. I know you started out by being scrupulously honest with your interrogators. Just tell us about your first night in that torture room.
It's like the first seconds, I assumed that the safest, wisest thing to do would be to tell them the truth, which is that I'm a journalist and I came to do journalism. But I realized in the first instance of this interrogation, they didn't want the truth. They had an answer that they were looking for, which is that I'm a CIA agent. The reason why I wrote about this in Rolling Stone is to impress on everybody how when you're trying to save your life, you know, you will tell them anything. You're happy to tell them that your grandmother is a CIA agent. You'll tell them anything because you're trying to cling onto this thing that's slipping from your grasp, and that's your life.
I think one of the remarkable things about your horrific story is that it actually goes right to this whole debate over what does torture actually yield in terms of useful information, truthful information. At a certain point, you decided you needed some true-sounding answers. So what kind of tales did you spin for these al-Qaeda guys?
You know, they want the names of the people who will betray Syrian Muslims to the CIA. So, because that's what they think the CIA is there to do, to get contacts on the ground in Syria who will tell the CIA where Al-Qaeda is. So I said, well, there's like Abdul Hamid, and his number is 456732. You know, I had to say that under torture in a way that sounded plausible. And I couldn't change the phone numbers, because if you change them, they go, you're lying. So I had to memorize all these phone numbers.
Well, you say in Rolling Stone that you actually lost control of your story details sometimes.
Of course. I mean, I kept lying to them. I couldn't remember the lies. And all of this made them think that I was lying more, so they tortured more. It's a terrible, terrible kind of system, but I can imagine that our own torture victims, the people we're torturing, go through the same stuff. So, because oftentimes those people don't have any useful information either.
And I'm imagining that, people who support Gina Haspel and people who believe that enhanced interrogation, as it's called, actually work, that, you know, for the CIA, they're professionals, and Al-Qaeda, well, those are the amateurs, of course. This is not a good way to go. What would you say to them?
I would say that torture bureaucracies, they tend to resemble one another. They corrupt the minds of the torturers. It's a very harmful thing to do to these people. Part of the reason why Al-Qaeda was having children torture me in the first place was because they know that it like perverts your sensibility, and they want to bring their children and the outsiders and everybody among them into line with the commanders. It just distorts your consciousness when you inflict that much pain on another human being. So we don't want this to happen to our own military guys. It is happening, of course, to the Al-Qaeda guys, because they have no conscience about this. But we should have we must have a conscience when we deal with our enemies.
So when you were in this torture room, you say your mind turned to those people, the psychologists, the CIA agents who tortured in the name of the United States at black sites. What exactly were you thinking?
I was thinking that they were getting promoted in life, moving forward, carrying on with very little regret, and that it's the civilians in the end, such as me, who go off and venture in the Arab world and try to understand the culture and explore and make friends, that we will be paying the price for their crimes. Because, they do bad things to their suspects. And who's going to pay that price? It's the U.S. civilian population in the end. We don't want that as civilians. We want to, like, our government should be making us safer. In fact, they're endangering us more.
Torture is abhorrent, and I think you can attest to that. Anybody who's read any accounts or documentation of what happens during torture would agree, and yet it's still debated. What does it tell you that Gina Haspel first refused to condemn it, and then, well, she reconsiders, and actually she regrets the brutal interrogation that prisoners were put through? What does that flip tell you?
Her record shows that she has supported torture when she was asked to do it. And then when she was asked to destroy the records of that torture, she also did that. And now it appears that she's being asked to repudiate all. That's what she's doing. Donald Trump is on the record as saying he loves waterboarding and he wants to get nasty. So, I mean, he says this on video. It's all over YouTube. I assume that she will carry on behaving as she has behaved in the past, which is she follows the directions of her commanders.
Writer and journalist Thea Padnos, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. In North Korea's version of the CIA, agents aren't just trained to gather intel, they also hack into banks.
They know it's technically illegal under international law, but their top motivation is pleasing Kim Jong-un and benefiting their nation. They're not going to feel guilty because they have a different moral code.
That story, still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The big question this week, one of the big questions this week, will they meet or won't they? Many have been asking that about the planned summit on June 12th between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Trump. The entire affair has been thrown into doubt by recent statements out of Pyongyang. North Korea said it might pull the plug if Trump insists on denuclearization, which Trump said he will continue to do. None of this back and forth surprises John Everard. He's Britain's former ambassador to North Korea.
In the past, North Korea has played a famous diplomatic trick of loading the negotiating table full of goodies, getting its negotiating partners slobbering in anticipation, and then almost at the last minute, pulling the tablecloth away and saying, no, you can't have these things unless you give us quite extortionate demands.
To be fair, there's a tendency to assume that North Korea doesn't see how it's viewed by the rest of the world. But observers say that despite its isolation, North Korea is actually quite plugged in, especially its Foreign Intelligence Bureau, North Korea's version of the CIA. They do intel. They also rob international banks. Yesterday, we told you about elite North Korean hackers pulling heists on banks, including the Federal Reserve of New York. Today, we hear again from Patrick Nguyen, who heads our Global Post Investigations Unit. He managed to track down some North Koreans in Seoul who once served in North Korea's intelligence bureau.
I'm in a drab cement building in a freezing stairwell, and I'm looking for a computer scientist who escaped North Korea. His office isn't well marked, because he likes his privacy. But I finally find it and ring the doorbell.
Come in.
Hello.
안녕하세요.
안녕하세요. Nice to meet you.
안녕하세요.
That is Kim Hung Gwang, 58 years old. He fires up a tea kettle and pours me a cup. Now, I've met North Korean defectors before, and some treat Americans with suspicion, which, fair enough. For much of their lives, they were trained to see us as, well, I'll let Mr. Kim explain.
You're jackals. That's what they say. Americans are our everlasting enemy, bosses of a corrupt empire. You're all invaders.
That said, Mr. Kim is really friendly. I can't say the same about this other guy in the room, a tall man in a dark coat, leaning against the wall, checking me out. I decide not to ask. The reason I'm here is to talk about hackers. Now, Mr. Kim is not a hacker himself. He's an expert in computer networks. And he once worked at a university connected to the military, where he trained young men to serve the Foreign Intelligence Bureau. He'd teach soldiers about networks so that, later on, some of them could go online to infiltrate networks around the world. He had a long career back in North Korea. So I ask him, when is the first time you heard this sound?
모뎀이라고 하는 사양이 저 사양의
1992, he says. That's the year he helped set up the first internet link between Pyongyang and his hometown, Hamhung, North Korea's second largest city.
남한에서 가장 높은 수준의 기술은 북한에서도 가장 높은 수준의 기술이고.
For the elites in North Korea, they've always had access to the newest technology, even though they don't share it with the masses. The technology gap between North and South Korea isn't as big as you think.
In 2003, Mr. Kim escaped North Korea. How he did that is another story, and I'll get to that later. But let's just say that today, he runs a club for North Korean defectors who are highly educated. And this gives him insight into the caliber of programmers north of the DMZ.
천재 어떤 사이버 요원이라고 봤을 때 그들과 북한...
They're the geniuses of North Korea. People say America has the best government hackers. Russia is number two, China is number three. But tell me, honestly, is anyone pulling off as many hacking operations as North Korea?
Okay, let's review some of North Korea's greatest hacks.
Sony Pictures Entertainment is reeling from what may be the biggest and most devastating computer hacking in Hollywood's history.
The FBI says that hack was revenge for making a comedy about assassinating Kim Jong-un. A slight departure from North Korea's hacking for cash. But then, after that, North Korea made money hacking Microsoft, infecting 200,000 computers and demanding ransom payments to unfreeze them.
Security experts say this is one of the worst and most widespread pieces of malware they've ever seen, especially...
And more recently, North Korean hackers have gone after banks all around the world. In South Korea, Thailand, India, the Philippines, Poland, Peru, Vietnam, Nigeria, Australia, Mexico, Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and in the U.S., Wells Fargo, Citibank, and the New York Federal Reserve, scoring a total of, and this is a lowball estimate, $650 million in just a few years.
한 목소리로 이야기하는 것들이 있잖아요. 다 보면...
So even just from reading the news, everyone should start to wonder if maybe North Korean hackers are maybe the very best in the world.
People around the world will think they're criminals, but I asked Mr. Kim, how do the hackers see their own jobs?
Americans will say, they're criminals. But in the mind of the hacker, he doesn't see himself as a criminal, does he?
불법이라고 하는 건 잘 알고 있죠. 그럼 불법과 불법을 넘어서서.
They know it's technically illegal under international law. But their top motivation is pleasing Kim Jong-un and benefiting their nation. They're not going to feel guilty because they have a different moral code. And hacking is a golden opportunity to show their loyalty to the country.
Look, Mr. Kim says, if you want to know more about the mentality of soldiers at the Reconnaissance Bureau, you should really talk to my colleague. He used to work there. So, a few days later, me and my co-producer, Sona Joe, we end up in some hipster co-working space on the other side of town, sitting across from a nervous 49-year-old man in a blue jacket. He introduces himself, and Sona translates.
대표 이사로 활동하고 있는 장세율이라고 합니다.
My name is Chang Se-yul. I arrived in South Korea in 2008.
Jang Se-yun is pretty cagey and vague on personal details. But he tells us he did work for the Intelligence Bureau for 4 years as a programmer creating software for war games. He was trained alongside the soldiers who went on to hack foreign banks. And they were all happy to be there, he says. In modern North Korea, everyone wants to be a cyber expert.
그렇죠. 이게 북한도 정보 산업의 시대라고 현 시대는 정보 시대, 전자전 시대라는.
If you become the cyber expert in North Korea, you can be treated as the senior manager in a communist party. So there's a very strong incentive. The boys and the men have a dream to go this path.
This dream is so widespread, Jang says, because say you come from a poor family with no connections, but you're smart and happen to be male, the government will train you up as a hacker. And that can bring perks that a North Korean rice farmer could only dream of. You move your family into a nice apartment in Pyongyang with hot water and electricity 24 hours a day. And you get special food, like bananas. Only elite North Koreans get to eat bananas. And if you're really good, they might set you up in China, where the internet is much faster. Also, since you're online, you're trusted to see all the things the regime would like to hide.
이 구두론 인터넷 세상을 자유롭게 드나드는 사람들이어서
They know the reputation about North Korea's dictatorship because they use internet freely, so they know it, basically.
Okay, what happens if one of these guys betrays the government? What will happen to their family?
잘 사는 그런 이제 전통들의 뭐 우대 아파트라고 하지만
Their families are living in a very wealthy apartment, basically. But I see them as a hostage. If those hackers are betraying the country or if they defecting the country, then I don't know, is the worst thing will happen to them.
What is the worst thing?
이제 명령을 수행을 한 군인이에요, 그들은. 그런데
I think the soldier family would be killed, of course, all of them.
Can I ask how he got here, or would he like to not talk about that?
Suddenly, Jang says, sorry, I have to go. I just remembered I have an important meeting with the South Korean army.
So he had a lunch meeting with the military service in Korea.
Oh, okay. That sounds important.
He says he's got to go, and then he just leaves. Now, I have to be clear. I don't have any reason to think his family was killed. He wasn't all that high-ranking, and also, he told me earlier that his wife and son did eventually make it to South Korea. Still, his hasty departure kind of leaves me hanging a bit. I'd really wanted to ask him, what exactly does North Korea do with all the money it makes from hacking banks? Fortunately, I know someone else who has the answer. Andrei Lankov, a Russian scholar with Kukmin University in Seoul and an expert on North Korea's economy. Lankov has a unique resume. Back in the 80s, he went to college in Pyongyang at Kim Il-sung University, the Harvard of North Korea. So I have to ask what that was like.
I expected to see a living hell, a low sky, always raining, people never smiling, slowly walking the streets, soldiers with machine guns, maybe watchtowers on every crossroad.
And what did he actually see?
Well, a lot of people were smiling. Weather was wonderful. It was September. And soldiers on the crossroads were occasionally present, but did not look menacing, and were definitely not going to start shooting at everybody.
So back to my question, how do they use the money stolen by hacking?
Probably some of this money will be used to buy Chanel bags for the mistresses of the top leaders. Some will be used to buy antibiotics for sick children. Some will be used to feed malnourished population, maybe old people. Some will be used to buy spare parts for the navigation system of a new missile capable of hitting New York.
You get the idea. The hacked money is used for everything, and now it's a vital source of revenue. When your national economy is roughly on par with the economy of Gary, Indiana, one big heist, a few million dollars, that can make a big difference, which is why hackers are so valuable to North Korea. And it's why the regime will risk giving its best and brightest minds free access to the web.
A North Korean hacker with the state, do you think that they worry about his ideology being poisoned?
They worry. They worry a lot, and he is subjected to intense indoctrination. Basically, he is bringing so much money to the state that state is going to overlook these problems. He is not going to start any opposition movement because it's a very painful way of suicide.
That brings me back to Mr. Kim, the computer scientist, the one who made me tea, the one with the suspicious-looking guy hanging out in his office. Even back in North Korea, Kim knew the regime was vicious, but he wasn't foolish enough to rise up. So he ran.
It's a fairly typical defection story, I guess. I bribed a soldier at the border, at the Tumen River separating North Korea from China. I started swimming. The water was freezing cold. Then, when I got halfway across, I heard the sound of gunfire. It turns out there had been a second soldier on the riverbanks who I did not bribe. His bullet didn't hit me, thankfully, and I made it across.
Today, Kim works with other defectors, helping gather intel on North Korea's hacking units.
I have to ask, do you have any safety concerns? Do you feel safe here in South Korea?
Well, I'm on their blacklist. There's a standing order to kill me. You may have noticed the man who's always with me, the guy over there who's always watching me, he's a South Korean agent. He's here to protect me.
This is the thing about defectors like Kim and Jung. Back in North Korea, their brainy know-how, it gave them status, perks, privilege. But once guys like this flee, well, they're no ordinary refugees. They can't just melt into South Korea and disappear. They're men who know a lot, too much. They're targets. And they feel that as long as the Kim regime stays in power, they'll always have to look over their shoulders. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Seoul, South Korea.
Patrick, that was an incredible story. I just want to ask you one thing before you go. We're on the verge of possibly seeing this historic sit-down with the U.S. president and the leader of North Korea. I'm wondering if you ask these high-level defectors what they think of what's going on.
Yes, of course. I had to ask Mr. Kim what he thinks about this, and his answer was really fascinating. He actually says that the U.S. is not being aggressive enough when it comes to backing down North Korea, and he thinks America is actually looking kind of weak to the dictatorship in Pyongyang.
That's what we were always told in North Korea, that America is a tiger with no teeth.
What about our big tiger, Mr. Trump? Do you have an opinion on him?
Well, he's so unpredictable. But Kim Jong-un is also unpredictable. So let's just say this. If they ever meet, it will bring together the two weirdest men in the world. Maybe it'll be a romance. Or maybe an action movie. We'll just have to see.
Yeah, double unpredictability. We will just have to see. Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Patrick Nguyen there. He heads up our Global Post Investigations Unit. Oh, springtime on the Korean Peninsula. The trees are blooming. The kids are playing. These kids, though, they're not playing at just any park. This is a park just outside Seoul that replicates the Joint Security Area, that special spot on the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. The real JSA, that's where North Korean leader Kim Jong-un recently shook hands with his South Korean counterpart, Moon Jae-in. But the fake one, it's got plenty of South Korean visitors lining up to visit. Reporter Jason Strother went along to see what all the fuss is about. So how does it compare to the real Joint Security Area?
Having been to both, I can make a comparison, Marco. Here at the fake JSA, far less soldiers, in fact, none, and many more screaming school children there on class trips. It's a tourist site. This is a movie set, actually. It was built for the 2000 film JSA by director Park Chan-wook, a sort of murder mystery that takes place inside the DMZ. And since the early 2000s, it's been a tourist site. So on any given day there, you see the school children, you can see couples strolling around, you see people taking selfies in front of the iconic replicas of the blue bunkers that straddle the demarcation line, and here and there you can catch some people getting their photos taken as they pretend to defect to the north.
I mean, I've been hearing about a lot more selfies lately, ever since the handshake between Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in. How much has the fake JSA grown in popularity since then?
Well, ever since the April 27th summit, the film studio has seen about a 30% increase in visitors to the JSA set. So a little more than 14,000 just in the first 2 weeks after the summit. And that you mentioned that historic handshake, I caught many people there lined up face-to-face, standing across from one another at the fake demarcation line and reenacting that handshake like these guys.
Jason, I'm thinking this is a dark bit of tourism for these South Koreans. I mean, Kim Jong-un is widely believed to have ordered the brutal killing of many suspected opponents, even close members of his family. So what do you think South Koreans are finding appealing about this place?
It's certainly not lost on them, the bit of fratricide you're talking about. Kim Jong-un is believed for, you know, calling a hit on his elder brother, Kim Jong-nam, last year. I spoke with one visitor to the JSA set. Her name is Chung Ye-in. She's 11. And she told me this. What she's saying is that her parents told her that Kim Jong-un killed his brother, so that scared her about him. But after watching the summit on her smartphone, she felt that Kim wasn't that bad after all, that he actually looked kind of friendly.
Yeah, so how widespread is that view, and how much did that simple but very staged handshake change South Koreans' views of Kim Jong-un?
Well, according to opinion polls here, really ever since the beginning of the year when North and South Korea participated in the Olympics, they fielded a joint women's hockey team, they walked during the opening ceremony under a unified flag. Public favorability toward North Korea and Kim Jong-un has been on the rise, and the summit, the handshake, and just kind of the chummy way Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un got along, it's made Kim Jong-un a much more popular figure here.
So obviously this week we've seen North Korea appearing to move the goalposts on the peace process. I'm sure a lot of South Koreans are skeptical of this trend. Are they now more realistic about Kim Jong-un's charm offensive?
I'm not too sure if it's really set in yet. I mean, this was sort of a stumbling block in these negotiations. Seoul is urging North Korea to come back to the negotiating table and resume these talks that were supposed to take place this week to implement some of the agreements made during the April summit, including setting up family reunions between North and South Korean relatives later this year. I think there's still a lot of hope that the North will come around again and that this is just a bit of bravado. But of course, not everyone has been sold on Kim Jong-un's charm offensive. Another gentleman that I spoke with at the JSA set, his name is Kim Hae-yun. He's in his late 70s. He said he never really thought Kim Jong-un was trustworthy, that he's all talk. And he told me a little more.
만약에 이게 저 이
Now he's talking about the upcoming summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. He says Donald Trump needs to make a very firm decision and decide if North Korea really wants to change, then we need to help North Korea. But if not, we need to make North Korea disappear.
Wild stuff, wild times. Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul telling us about the fake joint security area, although reporting from a very real Seoul. Thanks very much, Jason.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Nothing fake about the village of Kumakwane. It's in Botswana, and it's where Oteng Piet comes from. Kumakwane is on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, and Oteng Piet plays a popular style of music from there that can be best described as Botswana country folk. Pete's unique in many ways, though, starting with the instrument he plays.
I play the one-string instrument, which is called sekgaba in Setswana. I treat my instrument like my girlfriend, like communicate with her. This is why I call her my girlfriend. We never part. I decided to make my own sekgaba, and then I learned how to play it. I used to see some old men playing that instrument. I'm living in a small village, 25 kilometers away from the city Gaborone. It is still a developing village right now. It has got some hills, sandy, and there's a river there. And when it rains, it becomes green. It will be very nice for me to travel around if I can be a full-time musician. If I become a full-time musician, I can just quit my village, my home village, and stay where I can find a living.
Oteng Piet there on his handmade one-stringed instrument, the sekgaba. When he's not making music, Pete's a cook at the primary school in his village of Kumakwane. You can hear Oteng Piet as well as other artists from Botswana on the new recording, I'm Not Here to Hunt Rabbits. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.